Hello, and welcome to World History with Professor Roll. Our topic today is the early medieval world, a period often mislabeled the Dark Ages, and presented as a backward period when Europe descended into centuries of continuous warfare and cultural stagnation following the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, but which was really a crucial and vibrant period that laid the foundations for many modern national identities and nation-states that are still around today. Now, I'm your host, Dr. Daryl Roll, former trash man, lumberjack, and IT consultant, but now a professor of history, archaeology, and digital humanities at Calvin University. Now, you may be watching or listening because you're enrolled in one of my courses, because another teacher or professor assigned or recommended this, or you may have just stumbled upon my YouTube channel or podcast due to a personal interest in history or archaeology. Whatever the reason may be, I'm delighted that you're here, and I hope that you'll find today's episode interesting and worthwhile. So again, our topic today is the early medieval period. And we're going to be focusing in on what was happening in the territories of the Roman Empire, both in Western Europe and in the surviving Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire, which was centered in modern-day Turkey. Now, in the next half hour or so, we're going to explore some of the key developments that took place in Roman, or more properly, formerly Roman territories, from around AD 500 to 1000. But we'll actually start a little bit earlier, before the Roman Empire ever falls, just to ensure that we understand the immediate context. Now, if you've already watched or listened to my second Roman Empire episode, and if you're a student in one of my classes, you definitely should have. If you haven't, go watch it now. If you have watched this video, though, you'll already be familiar with some of what we're covering here, as there's a bit of overlap between this episode and the Roman Empire II episode. Now, as always, we don't have a lot of time, so this will necessarily be selective and somewhat oversimplified. Let's start by introducing and clarifying some key terms. We're going to start with a term that you've no doubt heard before, medieval, which is really a bit of a made-up word in modern Latin that means Middle Age or Middle Ages. Importantly, this is a modern term that refers to the period of time between the Roman Empire, or at least a Western Europe-based Roman Empire, and the beginnings of modernity, usually marked by the European Renaissance. Now, as the Renaissance has been viewed as a great period of reclaiming the supposedly lost greatness of the classical period that was represented by ancient Greece and Rome, the medieval period represents those years that sit between or in the middle of ancient or classical Rome and that perceived classical revival of the European Renaissance. And the idea of the Middle Ages is thus very much one that derives from that Renaissance period, and it partially reflects a view that the years in between the Roman Empire and their own time, that is the later 1400s and 1500s, were largely backward and wasted years. As you might imagine, more recent scholarship has been steadily demolishing this point of view, even if it does remain a powerful and popular perspective. So when were the Middle Ages or the medieval period? Well, it depends on who you ask and what parts of the world, and for Europe, which particular parts of Europe you're talking about. There are no strict beginning and end dates for this period. If we want to offer as simple a date range as possible, though, we could say roughly 8500 to 1500 for the full medieval period. But some scholars start this with the fall of the Western Roman Empire in AD 476, and others are willing to push it even earlier than that, into the early 5th century, or earlier in the AD 400s. Now, the end of the medieval period is also not strictly set, but it is usually considered to have run its course by no later than about AD 500, although numerous arguments can be made for the beginnings of modernity with Columbus's New World expedition in AD 1492, or with the sack of Constantinople and the end of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire in 1453, or even the late 1300s or early 1400s, when Florence, Italy underwent immense transformation after the Black Death or bubonic plague. But regionally, dates differ, and there are arguments that the Middle Ages didn't really end in England until the mid-1500s. The point is, almost all of the dates that we assign to historical periods, they're arbitrary. They are dates set by scholars, usually long after the fact, in order to simplify our studies and to create boundaries in which we can work. Nobody who lived during these transitions knew that they were living in the so-called medieval, Renaissance, or early modern periods. And honestly, nothing really changed for them overnight, or maybe not even in their lifetimes. But these kinds of terms and period designations are useful, even if their arbitrary and contested nature need to be fully understood. So if we can say that the medieval period, or the Middle Ages, runs from around AD 500 to 1500, give or take a couple of hundred years or so at either end, we can also break down this period into smaller units and terms. And dates may vary yet again. Now, the simplest division is to split the wider Middle Ages in half, with the period from around AD 500 to 1000-ish as the early Middle Ages, and the period from around AD 1000 to 1500-ish as the high or later Middle Ages. And our focus here is what we might call the early medieval or early Middle Ages. And we must remember that some people still refer to this period as the Dark Ages, but we are going to reject that term. Now, another important term that I think is important here is late antiquity. It's a much newer term that some historians and archaeologists use to refer to the long period of transition between classical antiquity and the Middle Ages. But I can hear you already asking, how can we define that late antiquity if the start of the Middle Ages is already so poorly understood? Well, that's a great question. Again, though, there is no strict start and end dates to the late antiquity, although we can roughly say that it runs from around AD 300 to AD 700. But some scholars would push it as early as AD 284, when the Roman Emperor Diocletian brought an end to Rome's crisis of the 3rd century. And for scholars in Western Europe, many people would put the end period as early as the AD 500s. Again, the point is that these dates are arbitrary, and terms like late antique or medieval are somewhat fuzzy. We need to be aware that real life doesn't just jump from one period to the next, but that there are long transitional fades. In this case, the events of what we might call late antiquity would prove to be very important for the later events and developments of the wider Middle Ages, including both its early and later divisions. Now, before we move on, let's talk a little bit about learning resources that you can use to supplement this discussion. Now, if you're watching or listening as part of one of my courses at Calvin University, we're probably using one of two books. For History 151, we're probably going to be using the free and open access textbook World History, Culture, States, and Societies to 1500 by Eugene Berger and others, which you can download for free from the University of North Georgia Press. And the period covered in this episode is discussed in Chapter 7 of this book. And that chapter is written by Andrew Reeves. Now, for History 262, Calvin's Early Medieval Worlds course, we may be using Barbara Rosenwine's Short History of the Middle Ages, and we'll focus a lot of our attention on the reading of primary source texts from the period. Obviously, Rosenwine's more specific book and the readings of primary sources from the period offer a much more in-depth investigation of this broad and diverse period. And I do strongly recommend reading much more widely than the Berger textbook. But if you're looking for an initial launching point to learn about the medieval period, Reeves Chapter 7 in the Berger book is a great place to start. And the rest of this episode is going to focus in on the general outline of that chapter as just a basic introduction to the early medieval period. So, now that we can define rough parameters for the early Middle Ages as from around AD 500 to 1000, what's the big story? Well, one big story is the rise and development of what Barbara Rosenwine calls the three sibling cultures of Western Europe, Byzantium, and the Islamic world. And it is in this period that Western Europe emerges from the end of Roman rule as a developing mosaic of new nation states that begin to resemble modern Europe, while the Roman name continues in the surviving Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire of the Eastern Mediterranean, and a new global power emerges out of Arabia and comes to sweep across the Middle East, Africa, into Europe, and into further Asia. Now we're going to be dealing with the Islamic world in a separate episode. So right now, we'll focus in on Western Europe and Byzantium. But it is really important to note that all of these societies were interlinked in numerous ways, and the actions of one often had reverberations that impacted the others. So let's look first at Western Europe in the dying days of the Western Roman Empire. As we learned in an earlier episode, the beginning of the end for Rome may be, arguably, the long crisis of the 3rd century that ran from the AD 230s to 284, when the empire was divided and near constant civil war saw dozens of supposed emperors leading armies and fighting for supremacy until Diocletian finally secured full control, dispensed with that long-held fantasy that the Republic was still going strong, and experimented with new ruling systems and multiple capitals, including an eastern capital at the old Greek colony of Byzantium. From this time onward, the Roman Empire would move mostly in the direction of division rather than unity. And by AD 395, there was a formal and permanent division of a Western, Latin-speaking Roman Empire and an Eastern, mostly Greek-speaking Roman Empire. In all this time, the Eastern Empire became ever more powerful and wealthier, while the Western Empire, including the city of Rome itself, became less and less important at a practical level. Environmental issues, political mismanagement, particularly in the West, and increased pressure from so-called barbarian groups from beyond Rome's frontiers all served to weaken the state. And during the 5th century, the Western Roman Empire fell quite rapidly between the AD 410 sack of the city of Rome by Alaric the Visigoth and the deposition of the last Western Roman Emperor in AD 476. Now, this is often presented as the result of barbarian invasions, but in reality, many of the so-called barbarians were invited by Rome and hired by Rome to serve as mercenaries to protect Roman territory from further barbarian groups. And Odoacer also known as Flavius Odovacar, is one important example. He is the barbarian leader who overthrew the last Western Roman Emperor. Although he may have been a barbarian Hun, he was actually serving as a general in the Roman army when he deposed Romulus Augustulus and declared himself to be king of Italy. Now, like Odoacer, other German peoples would go on to take control over Roman or former Roman territory. And by AD 500, the former Western Roman Empire would be dominated by four major groups: the Vandals in North Africa, the Visigoths in Spain and southern Gaul, the Franks in North Gaul and Germany, and the Ostrogoths, who had murdered poor Odoacer in Italy and the Northwest Balkans. Each of these groups had different levels of historical connection to Rome and Roman culture, with different approaches to how much and what elements of Roman ways of living they were willing to practice and maintain in the territories that they now controlled. Now, they also now found themselves to be the overlords of local people groups who already had much experience being lorded over by the Romans. And in most cases, these new regional leaders did not seek to destroy Roman life, but to live it, and to live it as earlier Roman elites had. And in fact, they usually championed Roman culture and local Roman institutions, even though Rome itself no longer ruled in those areas. Now, one uniting factor between each of these major groups was that they were all considered to be heretics by the Catholic Church. They were all continuing to follow the non-Trinitarian views of Arius of Alexandria, long after the doctrine of the Trinity was established as Orthodox Christian belief. And Arianism had been repeatedly condemned by successive church councils that were supported by the Roman government, mostly in the East. And the Arian controversy had erupted in the early AD 300s, and Arius and his followers were excommunicated at the AD 325 First Council of Nicaea, which had been called by the Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. But despite official and repeated condemnation, Arianism was a persistent problem for the Catholic Church, and it would be a defining issue for early medieval Europe, with royal households slowly renouncing it in favor of Catholic orthodoxy, but some continuing to publicly proclaim Arian beliefs until AD 671. And Clovis, the first king of the Franks, who reigned from around AD 481 to 509, would be the first of the Germanic leaders to convert. And this offered both benefits and drawbacks. It put him in sync with his post-Roman Gallic subjects. Those are the people of the former Roman province of Gaul, which roughly corresponds with modern-day France. And it allowed him to receive the support of the increasingly powerful Catholic Church, as well as the Catholic Emperor of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire in Constantinople. But it put him at odds with the other new Germanic kingdoms that were being established across the former Roman West, as despite Clovis's conversion, they all remained Arians for some time. Now, despite their interest in and efforts at maintaining elements of the former Roman society, the new Germanic states of Western Europe could not maintain, for many complicated and intertwined reasons that were mostly out of their control, they couldn't maintain the infrastructure and bureaucracy that was needed in order to support large urban populations. And most of Western Europe underwent a process that we call ruralization throughout the AD 500s as cities declined and life generally transitioned toward a more rural but less affluent lifestyle. And while all of this is happening in the former territories of the Western Roman Empire, the surviving Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire is flourishing and would see a bit of a golden age under the Emperor Justinian. Now, it is important for us to note that while we call Justinian's empire, and in fact its continuation all the way up to the fall of Constantinople, or modern-day Istanbul in AD 1453, the Byzantine Empire, as we call it, referred to itself as Rome. For the Byzantines, the Roman Empire never died, but was being continued uninterrupted by them. And it's also important for us to realize that this isn't crazy thinking, because the ruler of Constantinople had been the emperor of Rome all the way back to the time of Diocletian in the late AD 200s. And Constantinople had rapidly surpassed the city of Rome on a practical administrative level, hundreds of years before the Western Roman Empire had fallen. The truth is that for hundreds of years, Rome had become something bigger than the city that gave it its name. It had, by the time of Justinian, long ago become an idea that had symbolic and historical ties to a particular place on the banks of the River Tiber in Italy, but that had transcended that particular place. And Justinian remembered that important symbolic loss of the city of Rome and of the loss of all the great territories that the empire had lost when the West fell. And he actively sought to reclaim the lost glory of Rome during his reign. And he did so with a multi-pronged approach that included extensive and monumental public architecture and artistic works, including the world-famous Hagia Sophia, which would be the largest building in the world for centuries after its initial construction. He engaged in the systematic compilation and reformulation of a civil law code known as the Justinian Code, and also the military reconquest of lost territories across North Africa and Italy, including the city of Rome itself. Now, militarily, Justinian's campaigns were initially wildly successful, and he destroyed the Vandal Kingdom in North Africa and reclaimed that territory in less than a year. Distracted by military threats from the Neo-Persian Sasanian or Sassanid Empire in the east, though, the rest of his military results were more mixed, generally coming to a draw with the Sasanians intermittently for decades. His quest to reconquer Italy took nearly 20 years, in which Rome itself switched hands repeatedly, and the Italian cities and countryside were devastated. Till finally, with the help of the Lombards, the Ostrogothic kingdom of Italy was destroyed. Byzantine control over Italy would be short-lived, though, as the Lombards eventually turned on them and established their own Italian kingdom, leaving only the city of Rome and small portions of the Italian peninsula in Byzantine hands. In later decades, during the mid and late AD 600s, Justinian's hard-fought territories in North Africa, as well as the long-held Byzantine provinces across the Near East and Egypt, would rapidly fall to the rise of an unexpected new power, the Islamic Caliphate, that emerged in the aftermath of the Prophet Muhammad's establishment of Islam, which again we're exploring in a separate episode. Despite Justinian's great successes, Byzantium would end up facing some similar issues to those that were faced by the Germanic kingdoms of Western Europe. including a sharp transition from urban, city-focused life to ruralization, and reductions in interregional and intercontinental trade. Byzantium benefited from its ability to maintain a state bureaucracy, and despite sieges of the capital city of Constantinople in the late 600s and early 700s, was able to bounce back thanks to careful reorganization of the military and provincial government. Now, as Western Europe had continued to have its religious controversy in the form of that persistent Arian heresy, the Byzantine Empire's largest crisis, which had some relevance in Western Europe, was what it is called the iconoclast controversy. Now, this was a Christian religious dispute over the existence and use of icons, or stylized images, usually paintings, of Jesus, Mary, or other saints, that were increasingly used as aids in Christian worship, starting in the AD 300s. And this all came to a head in the early 700s, though, when opponents accused icon users of idolatry, worshiping these images rather than God himself. In some ways, this anti-icon sentiment may have been influenced by the new faith of Islam, which expressly forbid the use of images and claimed that Christians were practicing idolatry. Now, the two sides in this argument, or at least the Christian sides, were the iconophiles, or people who argued that it was okay to use pictures of Christ and the saints as worship aids, and that this was not idolatrous because the images weren't being worshipped, but God was. And the people that we called the iconoclasts, those who argued that it was forbidden idolatry to use images in Christian worship. And it was the Byzantine Emperor Leo III, who reigned from AD 717 to 741, who ended up siding with the iconoclasts, while the Empress Irene, who ruled on behalf of her infant son Constantine V from AD 780 to 797, sought to reaffirm the orthodoxy of icon use, calling the AD 787 Second Council of Nicaea to address the issue. Despite Irene's efforts, which were initially successful, the issue of icons would remain much disputed until 843, when the Empress Theodora finally overturned remaining iconoclastic policies. And as icons remain such an important part of Christian worship within the Eastern Orthodox Church, it is this decision that many historians mark as the period when we can begin referring to these Eastern icon-using churches as Eastern Orthodox. Okay, we're now nearing the end of our available time, so I'd like to tackle just one more topic before we summarize and close. And this last topic is the rise of the Carolingians as the new Frankish royal dynasty, and in particular, the reign of Charles the Great, more commonly known as Charlemagne, who the Pope would crown as the new Holy Roman Emperor. Now, if you remember from earlier in this episode, the first king of the Franks was a guy named Clovis, who was the first Germanic king of Europe to convert from Arianism to Catholic Christianity. Now, Clovis, who again reigned from AD 481 to 509, was the first ruler of what we call the Merovingian dynasty, which would rule over the Frankish kingdom until the mid-700s, when the Bishop of Rome, who we commonly refer to as the Pope, was increasingly seeking to distance himself from the authority of the Byzantine Emperor. And he entered into a cooperative alliance with a Frankish noble family called the Carolingians. And together, the Carolingians and the Pope deposed the Merovingian king. Now, the Carolingians received the Frankish throne out of the deal, while the Pope now had powerful royal and military allies who owed their throne to the Pope's support as the chief religious authority. And these powerful royal and military allies, the Carolingians, could do the Pope's bidding. And they allowed the Pope to operate free from Byzantine control. And this would be a major turning point in early medieval history. Within a few decades, the most famous of all Carolingian kings, Charlemagne, would be crowned Holy Roman Emperor by the Pope, an event that is said to have happened on Christmas Day in AD 800. And this coronation would be the culmination of the creation of a new society built on the wreckage of the former Western Roman Empire. And even today, Charlemagne is often considered to be the father of modern Europe, as his rule paved the way for Europe as we know it today. So, this has been a pretty condensed and packed overview of the early medieval period, and there are still many important elements that are left out. We haven't even talked about early medieval or Anglo-Saxon Britain, or the Vikings, who appear towards the end of the early medieval period, for example. They are covered in the Berger textbook, though, and in the Rosenwein text. So do be sure to check out whichever textbook you're using for your course. Now, some key points from this particular episode, though, just to wrap up. Number one, the so-called early medieval period, or early Middle Ages, can be said to last from around AD 500 to AD 1000. But honestly, the start and end dates are arbitrary, they're disputed, and they vary from place to place. Okay. Second, although this period is often still referred to as the Dark Ages, we've already decided in a previous episode that we're going to reject that idea. And you can review that information in our Roman Empire 2 episode, which spent some time focused in on the modern myth of the early medieval Dark Ages. Third, an associated term, much newer than the Middle Ages, is Late Antiquity. And this doesn't represent the same thing as the early medieval period, but it does have some significant overlaps. Now, the simplest chronological parameters for late antiquity is from around AD 300 to AD 700, and it is more directly defined as a transitional period from what can be seen as firmly rooted in the classical antiquity of the Roman Empire through the solid establishment of what pretty much all scholars would define as medieval. Fourth, perhaps the most important story of the early Middle Ages is the rise and development of three sibling cultures that emerged in the wake of the fall of the Western Roman Empire, and that all inherited and variously adapted a classical heritage that is at least partially derived from Greece and Rome. And these sibling cultures are Western Europe, Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire, and the Islamic world. Fifth, Western Europe comes to be dominated by various Germanic peoples who sometimes invaded, but sometimes were already invited and in the employ of Rome. And they go on to establish various successor kingdoms in the former Roman West. The main groups were the Franks, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Visigoths, each of whom start out this period as Christian, Arian Christian heretics, who didn't accept the Trinity and who believed that Jesus was not equal to God the Father. And this religious element would become a recurring issue and source of conflict throughout at least early medieval history and throughout the late antique period. Clovis, king of the Franks, was the first early medieval Germanic ruler to convert from Arianism to Catholic Christianity. Sixth, the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire viewed itself as the natural continuation of Rome, and while it would last until AD 1453, a particular highlight was the 6th century reign of the Emperor Justinian, who successfully reconquered North Africa and Italy, including the all-important, at least symbolically, city of Rome. He enacted important legislation, including the famous Justinian Code, and he engaged in extensive monumental architecture, especially church building, most famously Constantinople's Hagia Sophia. Seventh, perhaps the biggest major religious controversy in the Byzantine Empire was about iconoclasm, with the iconophiles supporting the use of images in worship, and the iconoclast rejecting it as idolatry. Throughout the 700s to 800s, this would be a back and forth issue that would finally be settled in AD 843, the point at which historians usually start referring to the Eastern icon-using churches as Eastern Orthodox. Eighth, and finally, Western Europe is forever transformed through the collaborative manipulations of the Pope and the Frankish noble Carolingian family. When the Pope gives papal approval for the Carolingian deposition of the Frankish Merovingian king in exchange for political and military support. Now, eventually, this would lead to the powerful Carolingian king Charlemagne being crowned as Holy Roman Emperor, setting up the future of Europe and its royal connections, for good or bad, with the papacy and the tension between papal and royal authority. Now that is all that we have time for today. Thank you so much for watching or listening. I do hope that you found this useful. If so, please like, subscribe, and or share, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to the podcast. Now, if you're on YouTube and you have questions, please do feel free to leave those in the comments below or contact me via email or social media. Until next time, take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye.